funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How good is your memory, and is it possible for those of us hopeless with names to learn to recall every new person we meet at our next corporate mixer or cocktail party? We might envy the gifts of those who can pull off such feats of memory, but it turns out they might just be hard workers who have put in long hours practicing memory techniques with ancient origins. When Joshua Foer went searching a few years ago for the world's smartest person, he discovered it would be impossible to identify someone as such with any certainty. He could, however, easily track down competitive memory champions and found himself so intrigued with their skills and dedication that he set out to join their ranks. He writes about what he learned in his most recent book, Moonwalking with Einstein, The Art and Science of Remembering Everything. The book is out now in paperback. Joshua, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So what made you go looking for the world's smartest person?
I guess just a sense of curiosity. I had seen a picture, came across a picture of the world's strongest man from the early 20th century, and I thought, God, you know, I'd love to see him standing next to the world's smartest man. That would be an awesome photo to hang over my desk. And, you know, once you enter the labyrinth of Google, where one thing leads to another, suddenly I was researching memory and eventually writing a book about it.
What's the relationship between memory and intelligence?
Well, I think, you know, we intuit that there is some sort of a relationship, and I think that that's because the things that make information more memorable are when we're able to put it in a context, when we sort of are able to figure out what's significant, what's meaningful, what's potentially relevant about a piece of information. And that's also sort of the core ingredients of intelligence. And so it's not a coincidence that people who often have terrific memories tend to be kind of more intelligent people, I think. I don't know.
And the more you can remember, the more you can recognize that other pieces of information might be significant and might match up with what you already know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's this old sort of cliche that when you put one piece of information in, it pushes something else out, and that's not the way our memories work. Our memories are these associational networks, and it's actually the case that the more you have up there floating around, the easier it is to bring in some new piece of information because you've got sort of more things that you can associate with it. So, you know, I say in my book that memory is sort of like a spider web, and the bigger it grows, the more it catches, and the more it catches, the bigger it grows.
On the other hand, we want some things to filter through that spider web, or else we couldn't really function.
Yeah, I mean, so I write about a character called S, who had one of the best memories of all time. He's sort of a legend in the scientific literature. And S was a journalist, and you'd think to be a journalist and have a vacuum cleaner memory would be an incredible asset. But actually, S was kind of incompetent. He couldn't really make his way through the world because he remembered too much. He didn't have that filter. And one of the things that I think you come away from S's story realizing is that it is forgetting as much as remembering that is at the essence of not just being human, but being a productive human.
So let's talk about the kinds of people, aside from yourself, who get involved in these memory competitions. A lot of people imagine that they are just preternaturally gifted, but in fact, they might just be really hard workers.
So this was my assumption. I had gone to cover one of these contests as a science journalist, essentially expecting to find the Super Bowl of savants. You know, I figured these people had to be freaks of nature. And when I showed up and saw them memorizing hundreds of random numbers after looking at them just once, entire poems in just a few minutes, the names of dozens and dozens of strangers, I basically was convinced of this. And I started talking to them, started talking to this one competitor in particular, a guy called Ed Cook, who had come over from England. And I said, you know, Ed, when did you realize that you were a savant? And Ed said to me, I'm not a savant. In fact, I have just an average memory. Everybody who participates in these contests will tell you that they have just average natural memories, but they've trained themselves using a set of techniques that were essentially invented in ancient Greece 2,500 years ago. And through technique and training, they're able to perform these utterly miraculous feats of memory.
So tell us the story of Simonides and how he figured all of this out, or most of it out.
So the story is, as it's been handed down to us by Cicero, is that Simonides was a poet in the 5th century BC in Greece, and he was attending a banquet. He was the hired entertainment, because back then, if you wanted to throw a really slamming party, you didn't have a DJ or a band, you brought a poet. And so he stands up, delivers his ode, walks out the door, and at the moment he does, the roof of the banquet hall collapses, kills everybody inside. In fact, it doesn't just kill them, it mangles the bodies beyond all recognition, so nobody can say who was sitting where, none of the bodies can be properly buried. But Simonides, standing outside amid the rubble, has this realization, which is that in his mind's eye, he can see where each of the guests at the banquet was sitting. And what he had figured out is something that I think kind of makes sense, which is that we have terrific visual and spatial memories. As bad as we are at remembering phone numbers and whatever word-for-word instructions from our bosses, we have terrific memories of space. And if you can trick your brain, essentially, into using its spatial memory, which is something our brains probably evolved. I mean, there's a sort of a good evolutionary explanation for why we have terrific spatial memories. If you can use your spatial memory to structure and store things that are otherwise not that memorable, the kinds of information our brains weren't built for, like, say, a list of random words or a string of random numbers, then that gives you a huge advantage.
Why were our brains built for space?
I think there's a plausible argument to be made that, look, our hunter-gatherer ancestors, what did they need to remember? Hmm. In the environment in which our memories evolved, like all of our other biological capacities, what did our hunter-gatherer ancestors need? They needed to remember the route back home, where to find resources, you know, which plants were edible, which were poisonous. And in part, at least, it was to meet those demands that I think our memories evolved in the ways that they did.
It's a remarkable phenomenon. I mean, I don't know what your neighborhood is like. I could walk all through mine, but if I had to give someone directions with street names, I couldn't necessarily do it.
Right, but so just as a sort of thought experiment, if you were to go into somebody's house, right, who you don't know, and just peek around, if you spent 30 seconds running through their house, you know, visiting each room, you would walk out of that house with a memory of where probably every, you know, where the sofa was, where the stove was, the kitchen, the bathroom. We don't register that as a feat of memory, but it's actually a lot of information. It actually sort of is a memory feat. And if you can, instead of remembering, you know, these where the sofa, where the stove, where the bathroom is in an apartment, if you instead were looking at images of things that you actually cared to remember, that is a technique. That's the technique that Simonides invented. It's called the memory palace. And the idea is you basically have an imaginary building in your mind's eye, and you walk through it, and you create images of the things that you want to remember. And surprisingly, shockingly, this is a really effective way to remember stuff. I mean, I sort of, after going and writing this article about this contest, I went home and I tried this. And I was astounded at how well it works.
So at that point, did you say to yourself, I am great at this and I have a shot at being the U.S. memory champion?
No. I mean, so I found myself totally fascinated by this, you know, rather curious contest, which turned out to be not just a curiosity, but sort of this knot that was at the center of all of these threads that led out to a host of really fascinating subjects about that I started pursuing, including sort of the history of memory. How is it that our ancestors remembered stuff, and how have our memories changed over the centuries? The science of memory. I mean, what is a memory? How do we? What are the potential? What is the potential in our memory? And I started going out asking all these questions and sort of doing a series of magazine stories around them. In fact, I think I was on this show a couple years ago talking about one of those magazine stories that
absolutely
kind of turned into this book. And I went to more of these memory contests, which are held all over the world. And I found that there was a problem in trying to write about them, which is that a memory contest is a pathologically boring test. I mean, it is truly like a bunch of people sitting around taking the SAT.
Uh-huh.
And as a journalist, you know, I need some drama. I need something to write about. And the most drama you get at a memory contest is when people start sort of massaging their temples. That's like pretty much all there is. And I realize there's incredible drama going on inside these people's minds as they're memorizing. And if I wanted to write about this, I was going to have to walk in their shoes a little bit.
So how many hours a day does it take to practice these things to the extent that you are really much better than the average person at memorizing, say, the order of a shuffled deck of cards?
Well, you know, so the basic techniques are pretty easy to learn. This is not rocket science. But to get really fluent with them, to become very fast, what you're training is actually not your memory, which is interesting.
Hmm.
What you're training is a kind of associational fluency. You want to get really good at dreaming up these crazy associations in your mind's eye, unforgettable associations very quickly.
And the more creative, the better.
Well, I mean, in the same way that if you saw somebody walking down the street carrying a tomato, that would be probably not something you remember.
Mm-hmm.
But if you saw somebody walking down the street getting pelted with tomatoes, and let's say that person was also wearing a bikini and, you know, all sorts of other crazy stuff was happening, that would be something that you would remember. And what you're doing in these memory contests is trying to dream up images like that that are so weird, so unlike anything you've ever seen before, that they will appeal to your imagination and therefore be memorable. And this is old advice. I mean, this goes back to the earliest memory treatises written 2,000 years ago in Latin. They talk about if you want to make stuff memorable, you've got to make it weird. You've got to make it raunchy. You've got to make it stinky. You've got to make it emotionally resonant in some way.
You know, it's interesting. A couple years ago, we took a family vacation to New York, and we were all wandering around Central Park. And the only person I remember with any clarity is about a 60-year-old man wearing a floor-length caftan in incredibly bright colors and all this crazy jewelry. And I couldn't tell you what anybody else looked like because they didn't surprise me.
Right. No. And in the same way, if you can create an image in your mind's eye that is that strange, it's likewise going to be more memorable.
So you don't believe in a photographic memory being something that some people might be born with?
I had assumed maybe these people have photographic memories.
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of my initial assumption. Turns out, first of all, if there was somebody with a photographic memory, they would come and compete in one of these contests and wipe the floor with everybody.
Sure.
Which is probably pretty good evidence that it doesn't exist. There is one case in the scientific literature of somebody with a photographic memory. It was a paper published in the journal Nature in 1970. And most psychologists now doubt that particular study. They ran ads in newspapers all over the world. If you've got a photographic memory, we want to hear from you. And nobody ever came forward who could, you know, actually perform this amazing feat in the lab.
Author Joshua Foer is my guest. We're talking about his latest book, Moonwalking with Einstein, The Art and Science of Remembering Everything. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Joshua Foer. We're talking about his latest book, Moonwalking with Einstein, The Art and Science of Remembering Everything. It's available now in paperback. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Joshua, you mentioned almost in passing earlier that Simonides of the Memory Palace was, in fact, a poet. Is there any evidence to suggest that the rhythm and rhyme that emerged in poetry had anything to do with the need initially to have this stuff committed to memory?
Yeah, I think pretty definitely. excuse me. You know, when the sort of scholars of oral traditions have gone back and looked at the great oral epics that have been handed down to us, the ones that have survived, they find that pretty much everything in the poem ultimately fits into some sort of a matrix that was there to help the poet remember what he had to say. And it might not be the case that, you know, Homer or whoever, whatever Homer was memorizing his poem word for word, but, you know, the rhyme, the meter, the alliteration, all of this stuff helped to sort of add an extra layer of cueing as to what word or what idea came next. Hmm.
We also seem to have really good memories for things like songs that we never set out to memorize, and yet most people know at least snippets of probably 1,000 songs.
Right. No, I mean, song is one of the absolute best mnemonics there is. It's the reason that we teach kids, you know, the ABCs in song rather than as 26 independent letters. And the reason is, music is one of the best structuring devices there is for language. You know, when you're singing something, you know that the line is about to go up or go down. There is, it might be about to return to some sort of melody that you'd already heard before. And that's like adding a layer of associations, a layer of meaning on top of the words themselves. And that's what makes it so memorable.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Seth in Fort Worth. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Well, Josh, I just wanted to say that I've read your book, and I thought it was phenomenal. I really did. I couldn't put it down. And like you said, you're trying to capture some of the drama of the competitors, and I think you did a fantastic job of that because I thought the book was just incredibly entertaining.
Wow. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. So I'm a medical student, and I read your book, and I used some of the techniques, some of the things I could abstract from the book to help me in studying anatomy. And I was just wondering, you know, in your tour across the country talking about the book and all the conversations you've had, have you had any conversations with other people sort of learning anatomy or other, you know, just students in general? Has anyone come forward and said, oh, hey, I've used some of these techniques that I saw in your book? And if they've had any success with it.
Well, before we get an answer from Joshua, Seth, tell me, did you use a memory palace and say, okay, the liver goes here? And I mean, how exactly did you apply things?
Well, version one was I did exactly what he said, where he said in the book, he says to imagine a room and to fill that room with different objects that represent the things that you're trying to memorize. And so I would say if I was memorizing some of the muscles in the pelvic region, the piriformis muscle is in the pelvic region, and I would imagine a pyramid in the left corner of my bedroom, and that was just one way. And then the second version that I did was to kind of imagine the objects more on my body, you know, using the spatial relationships of the actual muscles on my body, looking at my body to help me memorize the stuff.
So is it easy to then translate when you're working on a patient somewhere? Can you instantly remember, or do you have to think about the left corner of your bedroom?
No, it's honestly not that easy to instantly translate because, as you were saying, a part of the system is learning how to translate between your code and the real meaning that you were encoding, you know. So it does take, I mean, it still works no matter how you go about it.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Seth. And Joshua, what have you heard from other people who've read and maybe used the book?
Well, in this case, so my wife is actually a medical student, and she was studying for the boards, and we had a real, like, all right, rubber meets the road. You know, can we really help her out? And what we found my wife and I going through and trying to, you know, help her study for the boards is that there were places where, you know, memory techniques were really helpful and places where they kind of weren't that helpful. It's interesting. I mean, with the anatomy, I think Seth's notion of, you know, creating these images and actually tying them to the body rather than to, you know, some sort of abstract space makes a ton of sense. Because why add that extra layer of, you know, decoding?
Yeah.
For the memory palace works really nicely for the kinds of information that's highly structured and where there is a sort of order that you need to remember. So biochemical pathways was one place where she found that very useful. Also, you know, one of the things they make doctors memorize is all these pharmacological, like all these drugs and their potential side effects and, you know, what they can't interact with, et cetera. And that was a place where there's just like, this is just raw information. And the only way to learn it is to memorize it. And we found that coming up with images and doing the sort of memory techniques that we're talking about here was really effective for that.
So these days, of course, there are a lot of, you know, iPhone apps that would provide that information at one's fingertips. Is it possible that doctors won't be expected to memorize all of this going into the future?
You know, I think there's a pretty strong case to be made that some of this stuff that they make doctors memorize, that they really cram into their skulls, really doesn't need to be memorized anymore because we've got these external memories that are now, you know, really just a thumb click away. You know, they can find out what all of the drug interactions are for this drug. They may prescribe once in their career, mm-hmm. You know. But there are other kinds of information that, you know, doctors that really do need to have accessible because, I mean, the way the mind works is we're constantly filtering our perceptions through the lens of all of these memories that we've got floating around in our minds. And to the extent that we, you know, you don't quite know how that process works. It's sort of like some sort of alchemy, mm-hmm. The way that we actually make sense of the world in the light of the past. But clearly you need the raw material up there for that to happen.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Wade on the line now in Plano. Hello, Wade.
Hi.
Go right ahead, please.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was just going to make a comment that the downside of a prodigious memory can sometimes be a curse. I know personally that happens to me a lot. Like, I have a very good memory. People think that I'm really smart or something. That's not the case. I just remember what I was told or where I learned it. And if something catches my attention, it's in there forever. And whereas if you have an argument with someone that you've had the same discussion three other times, it can drive you up the wall. So yeah. I was just wondering, is there an opposite of how to deal with a big memory?
An art of forgetting. the paradox is the more you sort of want to forget something, the more you end up thinking about it. Hmm. And that's the recipe for making it more memorable.
Well, what does it take to clear out your memory palace? I mean, there's only even someone who goes around looking for spaces has a limited vocabulary of physical spaces, for example, to use as memory palaces. How do you clear those out?
Well, the people who compete in these contests will have dozens, if not hundreds, of spaces set aside in their minds to hold memories, which I find like straight out of a Borges story. They have these kind of metropolises of mental imaginary buildings. Hmm. For the rest of us, we probably don't need that many because you can reuse them. You just can't reuse them right away. So if there's something, you know, for example, I give a book talk, right, that I end up giving sort of pretty regularly.
Sure.
And I've set aside a place, a building, a memory palace to hold that, to hold each of the points that I want to talk about. And I can't really use that space for anything else right now. But there are other spaces that I might have that I plug stuff into. And frankly, if I don't think about it for, you know, a week or a couple days even, those memories will start to fade, and then you can reuse the space.
So the individual memories might fade, but as for these techniques, once you've got them down, is it like riding a bicycle? You could not do this for 10 years, and then you could go back and call on a memory palace to memorize something new?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, this is not rocket science. The thing is, for example, memorizing numbers. It's not just that you're using a memory palace, it's that you've actually got some sort of a code that you're using to make those numbers into images that are then memorable. And that's what you develop a kind of fluency with.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when I was in top shape competing in this contest, I could remember hundreds of random numbers. Today, I can remember a credit card number, no problem.
Uh-huh.
But if you gave me a long sheet of hundreds of numbers, it would take me a little bit of time. You know, I'd be much slower at it than I was when I was practicing this pretty regularly.
How did you measure your progress?
I kept meticulous records. Part of what I got into in my research was sort of the science of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this whole field of psychology that is devoted to understanding how people get to be good at what they do, how people develop skills. And one of the things that I came away from the literature really convinced of was that I needed to completely geek out with my data collection and keep not just sort of records, but also keep a journal. You know, I tried this and it didn't quite work, and I wonder why. And in the process, I learned, you know, how I needed to improve or what was causing me problems. And I think that was actually part of why I was able to go from, you know, just regular journalist to memory champion in a year.
It really does speak to sort of the effort, because I think, you know, just as you say, anybody can do this. It's a question of will, in the same way that anybody can learn to be at least proficient on a musical instrument, but lots of people don't want to put in the sweat equity.
That's right. I mean, there's no way around it. Getting good at stuff takes time. It takes effort. It takes practice. But it doesn't just take practice. It takes the right kind of practice. And that's one of the really interesting things that I write about in the book, and that in a way is like the most universal sort of thing that I took away from this experience, is the importance of deliberate practice, of practicing in efficient ways where you're forcing yourself out of your comfort zone regularly, watching yourself fail, and then essentially studying your failure and what caused it and how you can then do it better.
Am I correct that you cannot multitask, Joshua, when you are trying to work on one of these memorization tasks?
Well, I mean, look, memory is ultimately all about attention.
Mm-hmm.
Samuel Johnson said the art of remembering is the art of paying attention. And the reason these memory techniques work is that they're basically just relying on some sort of fundamental principles of how our brains work. And one of them is that they're kind of forcing you to encode deeply, to pay attention, to be really engaged with what you're learning, which is sort of a fundamental component of remembering. And so to the extent that you're, you know, multitasking or doing other stuff, whether you're trying to memorize a pack of playing cards or just trying to, you know, remember a conversation that you're having with somebody, if you're typing on your iPhone, you're not gonna remember.
You know, we've talked to the neuroscientist David Eagleman on this show about temporal perception and new memory and the relationship between those things. Talk about what you learned about that.
Well, you know, there's this wonderful, strange phenomenon that everybody recognizes, which is time seems to speed up as we get older. And what is going on there? Why is that? And one of the answers, which goes back to William James, the seminal American psychologist writing at the end of the 19th century, he said, you know, our memories, our chronological memories, our memories for our lives are structured around sort of landmarks. You know, we remember that this happened, you know, right after our vacation to Paris, or something else happened right after I landed that job. And we have these landmarks that in our sort of story of ourselves are like like lighthouses. They sort of illuminate what is around them chronologically. And when we're young, we're constantly having these new experiences that are memorable. And we're constantly encountering things for the first time. Our lives are filled with variety. And that makes not only a more memorable life, but a seemingly slower passage of time. And then as we get older, our lives fall into these routines, and we have fewer and fewer completely new, completely memorable experiences. And as a result, time seems to fly by more quickly.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Dan in Flower Mound. Hello, Dan. Hi, Dan. Okay, we don't have Dan with us. Talk about this. There is this idea that some people have that you can recover a memory that has been lost. But in fact, perhaps the memory wasn't lost. It's simply we hadn't thought about it because nothing had jogged our memory before. Is that right?
Well, you know, it used to be the case that psychologists would tell you, look, we are like these perfect recording machines, and everything that we see gets filed away somewhere. And if we can't remember it, it's just because we can't find it. I think most psychologists would now tell you that's not the case. Forgetting is a real phenomenon. I mean, it's happening at the cellular level in our brains. But at the same time, I think we've all had this experience where something will just cue some old memory that we can't even believe we still have. And it's one of these, when that happens, it's one of these moments that makes you realize how incredible our memories are. That, you know, we can have things socked away up there that would have seemingly been completely forgotten about, and yet with just the right cue, we can manage to fish them back out of our memories.
Author Joshua Foer is with us. We're talking about his most recent book, Moonwalking with Einstein, The Art and Science of Remembering Everything. The book is available now in paperback. If you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Joshua Foer. His latest book is called Moonwalking with Einstein, The Art and Science of Remembering Everything. Join our conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next on the phone to Robert in Murphy. Hello, Robert.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
Joshua, I really enjoyed the book. I got the idea that the book was initially about how this was done, and without, like you said, you weren't really planning on becoming a memory champion, but you did. How has your life been affected since then with what you learned, though? Like, if you hadn't gotten, like, the royalties and things from the book, just had put the time in, was it a good ROI, you know, return on investment of the amount of time you put in to learn all this stuff to, you know, what you're using now, or how's that working out?
That's an interesting question. I would say, you know, I ended up getting a lot of enjoyment out of the exercise and sort of just the experience of trying to push myself in the same way that I think people who run marathons get some sort of enjoyment out of just that exercise of seeing, like, wow, what am I capable of? And I wouldn't have kept doing it, I mean, even apart from my journalistic curiosity, I wouldn't have kept doing it if it hadn't been fun. So that's, I guess, one answer to the question. I think the other part of your question is, well, all right, so is this worth it in the rest of your life? And the answer is, I think, probably all of the training that I did was a little bit overkill. but there are places where I find this stuff useful in everyday life. One of the things that I actually found it to be very useful for, which I didn't particularly write about in the book, and I kind of feel like that was a mistake, is these techniques are really handy for remembering speeches. And I guess that's actually what they were invented for, right, for oratory rhetoric. And now that I've written a book, I actually have to give speeches, which is something I didn't have to do before. And I found that the Memory Palace in particular is a really effective way of doing that, talking from memory. And I guess if I had realized that that was going to be a part of my life, I might have spent a little bit more time in the book writing about that.
So how much information can you sort of chunk from a speech and put in a particular location in a memory palace? Explain how that works.
Okay, so I do it the way that Cicero says that you should do it, which is you create an image for every topic that you're going to talk about. You try and memorize your speech word for word, that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
That you're going to sound like a robot, and you're going to forget a word, and then you're going to, you know, be lost.
You get flustered, and then, right.
Mm-hmm. So Cicero says, all right, memorize your speech point for point, topic for topic, and then give yourself a little bit of freedom to riff, so long as you know you've got this roadmap to come back to. It's interesting, you know, the phrase topic sentence comes from the Greek word topos, which means place. And that's a vestige from when people used to think about oratory in these sorts of spatial terms. Another one, in the first place, that's like in the first place of your memory palace.
Hmm. We have an email here from Judith who says she's preparing for the LSATs and wants to know if you have tips to suggest from what you have learned in order to prepare for the exam.
I actually don't know too much about what an LSAT looks like.
I think it's a lot of logic. I don't know. I've not taken
it. Yeah, unfortunately, I suspect that those tests are set up to really not be gameable by memorizing stuff. They're, you know, ultimately, if they're logic tests, they're logic tests. They're not memory tests.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Tom in Richardson. Hey, Tom.
Hi. Really enjoy listening to the program.
Thanks.
I guess one of the things that was said there a moment ago sounded like my question is a little bit different then, but the perception of the passage of time, it seems like you said that that's inversely proportional to the time rate of memorable events. Is that kind of a good description of that? I'm getting a little older. That's why I'm wondering.
Yeah, no, I had never put it in those terms, but I think that's right. And you know, there is like a sort of a practical lesson that comes out of that, which is, all right, so live a memorable life. Go out and do fun stuff. Go put yourself in strange situations. Take, you know, vacations to exotic places. Make sure that your life is not just one unending routine.
It also speaks to maybe it's important for kids to have time to just ruminate on things as opposed to having every spare minute filled with an activity.
I mean, I believe that. I believe that probably for reasons much more important than having to do with anything with memory. Just, you know, giving kids time to play is important for a whole bunch of reasons, I think.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Daniel in Austin. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Well, I will regularly go to the grocery store with a list of things from my life and come home missing four or five major items, even while holding the list. But I'm a professional musician, and I, on average, have an instant recall when I'm playing a show, somewhere between 70 and 80 songs and the lyrics. But what's interesting is that, kind of as to a couple callers ago, if I am in the middle of a song and I forget the tail end of one verse, it'll sometimes throw off the entire memory of all the rest of the lines for me. But it doesn't relate to, say, building a memory palace or any kind of tricks. But I can't remember unless I'm playing.
Hmm.
If I just stand and try to think of lyrics, I have a very hard time with it. How has that kind of related to anything in your studies or as you were writing this book?
Yeah, I mean that is because you've got those associations. I mean your brain when you're playing that chord is making a connection to a lyric that you've linked with that chord, and so it's not a coincidence that I think you find it easier to remember the lyrics when you're playing the instrument. You know, there have been studies that have shown if you tell somebody to remember the phrase "pick up a pencil," and you tell somebody else remember the phrase "pick up a pencil" while they're actually picking up a pencil, the person who was actually picking up the pencil is going to remember that phrase better.
And I guess telling somebody pick up a pencil is not ever as memorable as, say, pick up an elephant or something really extreme and unusual.
If you tell somebody to pick up an elephant, they're not going to forget that.
We have an email here from Ashraf in McKinney who asks if you would talk about smells and odors and their associations with memory.
Smells, obviously, we've known forever, can transport you and take you back to your childhood. There's the famous Madeleine from Proust. And one of the things that's interesting about smell and memory is that our olfactory bulb, the sort of part of the brain that is involved in processing smell, really is directly connected to regions of the brain associated with making memories. And unlike some of our other senses, which sort of go through an extra layer of processing, smell seems to tap straight into our memory. And one of the consequences of that is that we are extremely bad. While we're extremely good at remembering smells, we're extremely bad at putting words to describe them. And that's part of the reason. That's actually an artifact of the structure of our brains. And it helps explain why sort of all food criticism or people talking about wine or it all sort of faintly smells a little bit like bologna, you know? And that's because it's just something our brains weren't really built to be good at.
So talk about this. I mean, obviously, at this point, the book has been out for a year, and now you're in the paperback publishing interviews. After a while, every interview must get to feel the same for you. Is it hard for you to remember what you've talked about with somebody you discussed the book with a week ago?
Yes, mm-hmm. And that it reveals something about how our memories work. For the same reason, you know, if I asked you, what did you have for lunch last Thursday, you will probably have a tough time recalling that.
Sure.
And that's because lunches, even though we might eat something different at each lunch, they're all sort of the same and get kind of blended together in our memories, grouped together under this generic category, lunch. and what ends up happening is we lose the specifics. And in the same way, you know, anything that we do that becomes routine is going to have that happen to it. And, you know, so talking about the book in the same way, only to different audiences, I fear that that has sometimes happened to me, that I've kind of lost my memories of some of the specifics.
Let's go back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. We have Robert on the line in North Richland Hills. Hello, Robert.
Hello. I didn't catch the program until about 20 minutes ago, so I didn't hear the first part, but it kind of reminded me of a book I purchased back in the early 70s called The Memory Book by Harry Lorraine and the Ohio State and New York Knicks basketball star Jerry Lucas. And I was kind of curious whether the author had ever read that book and whether his technique is similar.
Yeah, I have. It's a classic. And the stuff that they wrote about in that book is, you know, the same basic techniques that go back all the way to ancient Greece. It is the case that these memory competitions are sort of like an arms race where every year people come up with sort of new variations on the theme, new ways to remember more stuff more quickly. And so it sounds funny to say this, but the state of the art has actually evolved since the 70s. I mean, it evolves every year when you go to these memory contests. Somebody's got a new trick to remember more stuff, and that's kind of part of the fun of continuing to keep an eye on this sport.
Americans are not known for being particularly adept when competing on a global scale.
Americans on the competitive memory circuit are like Jamaican bobsledders. I like to think that when we show up at an international competition, we are the coolest guys there, but we perpetually get whooped by just about everybody. I think that may be about to change. We've got the current U.S. memory champion is a guy called Nelson Dellis, who is, in addition to being a memory champion, he's climbed Mount Everest. That tells you a little bit about what kind of a guy he is. And he seems to be taking America to the next level, finally. I think this year at the World Championships, we may have a chance of showing up our European colleagues.
So I'm guessing you have to be sort of obsessive to get very good at this.
Well, you have to be driven, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the fact that Nelson, 3 weeks after winning the U.S. Memory Championship, decided he was going to climb Mount Everest, that tells you something about his personality, right? He is somebody who likes to push himself. And that's the kind of people who participate in this quote-unquote sport. Many of them are also, in addition to being mental athletes, are physical athletes, the people who like to, you know, to see how fast they can run.
Joshua, I know that Columbia has purchased the movie rights for this book. It's not a documentary, right? They're thinking about making a narrative film?
I think that's the idea, yeah.
And so do you foresee a way that making these that you can make these championships exciting in a way that you struggled with even when writing the book?
I'm hoping that, you know, the magic of movies can do that. I wouldn't have guessed that The Social Network would have been a great movie, but,
yeah.
Or The King's Speech, but you know, sometimes there is drama in the least expected places.
Any fantasies about who would portray you?
Dwayne Johnson.
I don't recall there being a physical resemblance, but maybe that's not important.
you asked for a fantasy. Who would portray me?
Okay, so the last thing I want to ask you is you write about and you have spoken about the importance of paying attention. Is there anything in your life that you specifically, at this stage, have decided based on what you've learned through all of this investigation to pay more attention to?
Yes. I would say everything. I mean, truly, this is the lesson that I took away from this experience and that I hope other people will take away from the book, which is that there actually are no shortcuts. I mean, these memory tricks are shortcuts, but they're really not shortcuts. What they're doing is they're forcing you to be more mindful, to pay attention, to use your imagination in a way that we don't normally exercise. And those capacities are latent in all of us, but we have to activate them. You have to be the kind of person who remembers to remember. And that's something that I try and tell myself all the time. This is about more than just, you know, memory tricks. This is about living, hopefully, a more memorable life.
Joshua Foer's latest book is called Moonwalking with Einstein, The Art and Science of Remembering Everything. Joshua, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email any comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.